But I thought this would be an interesting way to start is about Oni. I don't know how many of you know Oni, but he's a very important animal. I came across him when they, I think it was 1978 or 9, they had an envelope for honoring veterinary medicine. We can leave a little light on, I guess, or but that's all right, I think. And I found out about Oni from the Postmaster General. And so I wrote to him, and he sent me this picture and a story about Oni, because I'd heard about Oni. He came to the post office in Albany, New York, in about 1880, late 1880s, early 1890s. And I don't know why they call him Oni, and I don't know what that means, but this is a picture from the Smithsonian. And Oni, the clerks there got really attached to Oni, and then he'd ride the these little drayage carts down to the railroad station with the mail. And then one day they put him on, he liked to ride, and they put him on a mail train up to the next town. And they'd put one of these, in those days, you know, on the mail bag, you'd put the destination. With one of, those are all destinations there, see? Put on the mail bag. Well, they put it on Oni. So he went up to the local town and came back. Well, over the next number of years, he really loved riding on trains. And then, of course, they had telegraph, and they'd always tell when Oni was coming. He went out to all the states of the nation, of the lower 48 at that time. And he also went in Mexico and Canada. He got in the Huasca in Canada. He ran into trouble up there, so they had to bail him out. And then they decided they'd send Oni around the world. So he went by mail train up to Tacoma, got on a mail boat, and he was heralded then in the big important centers, I think the key to Shanghai or whatever it was, and all these big towns throughout the world. And I think through England, came back to the East Coast and was welcomed back there. And then they ran and put him on the mail train and got him back out to Tacoma. So he went around the world in about 140 days and had a great time, greatly honored. And then not long after that, postal clerks, national conference in San Francisco, and they introduced Oni up front, and everybody stood up and clapped for 15 minutes. I don't know if that's an assistant's dog, but it meant a lot to these people. They bought him this jacket because he was running out of places to put all these destinations, and so that's Oni's now in the Smithsonian. And that's his picture, or that's a picture of him in the Smithsonian. He was a friendly dog, but you better not monkey with his tags and that stuff. He didn't like that. So that introduces assistance dogs. I imagine people have trained animals for special assistance throughout much of history, but in an organized sense. The guide dog or seeing eye dogs are probably best known, and they started about the seeing eye dog people started about 55 years ago or so. So it gives you some time frame on this. This is Gail Riddle in Vancouver, and I'll never forget. This is her third hearing dog. She's a mother, professional woman, and also here cyclist. And this is, I say, her third guide dog, and I'll never forget what she told me. She says, this dog is not only my eyes, it's my freedom. And the only thing I want to point out here, because you all know guide dogs well, and there's five or six or seven places in the United States where they're trained now, and most of them, I think, are good training centers. But you, as an observer, you never interfere with a guide dog in harness, and you never pet them.
Unless they're late, they're...
Yeah, when they're in harness.
Yeah.
When they're in harness. When they're in harness. Yeah. But once they take off their harness, they're all together, they're like they're schizophrenic. I mean, when they're in harness, they're all business. Right? Take off their harness, and some of them just loo, like calves out of the stall in the spring. They really have a good time and enjoy life. But they take the business seriously. The Hearing Dog, as an organized program, was probably the next in the series. And this came about rather in an interesting way. It was in Minneapolis, and a lady had a dog that she had trained to be a hearing dog for her, and it died. So I think she called the local TV station or something and said, I need another hearing dog. Well, of course, nobody knew what a hearing dog was. And so they said, well, maybe you contact the local Humane Society. So they set up a program, but they realized it was too big a job for them. And so they contacted the American Humane Association, whose headquarters in Colorado at the time, and they set up a program that lasted for quite a number of years, and then other people picked it up. So there's quite a few hearing dog training centers now in the United States. The first placement of a hearing dog was from the American Humane Association, and that's Ranger with Mrs. Christensen and the lady that brought her up. And I was out there for the, I was on the evaluation post-placement. And it was an interesting day. The chief was with me, and we went out, and the dog, of course, came to the door and checked us out. I mean, I could hear him inside the door. And I'm sure it knew that Laura was there because she knew Laura, could smell her. And then she ran back and got Miss Christensen, brought us in, and then we tested out the dog. We after a visit, she lay down the bed, and the dog, of course, they're trained to accompany them. And we set the we had a tape. She had made a tape and played the smoke alarm, and the dog jumped, of course, on top of Miss Christensen and got her up and out towards the door, and then she came running out in the living room and jumped on the chief and me, another lady with us who usually comes up here.
Carol Storch.
Yeah, Carol Storch was there. It was very fortunate because she went on into then learning sign language and was very interested in the hearing handicap, and she sort of led the program here for Hearing Handicap Week several times. I don't think she'll be here this year, but she's in the Tacoma area and works with Hearing Handicap. And so she was there too, so we had a very good time of it. And then we tested out the telephone, played the tape for the telephone, but it was a poor rendition. An old ranger looked at the tape recorder, looked at her, and looked at the phone, and says, you know, somebody's pulling my leg. And then we asked Mrs. Christensen, what, are there any other problems? Yes, she says, he isn't responding to the alarm, alarm clock. Checked it out, and it was one of those buzzing alarm clocks, and it was trained to a ringing alarm clock. And the dog, you know, I think of Pavlov, trained it to detect C-sharp from Z-flat. They have very good ears when they're young. And so we give her a different alarm clock, and then she said goodbye. And I'll never forget what Miss Christensen told me as I left. She says, as much as I needed a hearing dog, I needed a companion more, because she'd recently been widowed, and her children were all gone. And I didn't see Miss Christensen then for a long time. One day I went to the prison, Purdy Prison, as a visitor. It's a maximum security prison for women. And I came into the waiting room of the prison. They were going to have a dog and pony show there. Only dogs, so no ponies. And they were in the waiting room, these people. And I didn't really recognize them right off, but when you get my age in my business, you look at the dogs. And I knew that dog, but I couldn't remember where it was. And suddenly Miss Christensen says, say, you were at my house many years ago. And certainly that was Miss Christensen. What had happened is she was over there for remedial therapy for the dog and also for her. Because for all of these, including Dingbat here, they need, and the chief, they need continuing education, you know, to be retrained, sort of, and pick up where they've done wrong. And what had happened with Miss Christensen, she'd gotten stone deaf. And she was hollering at the dog and doing other things. She was a bit lax with it. So they retrained Ranger. Unfortunately, about a year after this, a Ranger died, and I got a desperate call. I mean, she was really lost without Ranger. So, but now she's got another dog. So that's a happy story. Canines you can count on, and that happens to be from Better Homes and Gardens. But and I don't want you to read this, but just to point out that there's now a lot of activity in many centers training dogs for special purposes. And I'll tell you about Chris there in a little while. And Chris's dog, boy, I've forgotten Chris's dog's name. It's Ivy. Yeah, it's Ivy. And so I'll give you just a couple of these programs. Handy Dogs down Tucson. A person committed to a wheelchair is in charge of this. And they train a variety of dogs. And what they do is bring in the people and help them train a dog to help them, you see, to train the assistant dog under their tutelage. And it's worked out really quite well. And I've observed this program, and they've given demonstration. In fact, they got a special program award from the Delta Society, as has the Canine Companions for Independence, which is probably the best known. They have offices overseas. They have offices, their principal offices are in Santa Rosa, California. And they have a puppy raising program, something like the guide dog program. Seeing guide dogs, maybe if you don't know it, they put out their animals for socialization when they're quite young, a few months old till they're about 14 months old, usually with a 4-H or FFA family to socialize them. And I depart from my unprepared text to tell you also, when I was in Australia the first time, with a symposium, they told me there that they had utilized something that I tried to get started here. They had prisoners socialize guide dogs. And they found out with the dogs that they gave the prisoners to socialize had a lower flunk out rate than those that went to families. Because the prisoners really worked it. And really did a job on them. And they sort of fudged on it because they gave the toughest animals to the prisoners. So it was, they were leaning that way. But they have discontinued that, but they're trying to get it going again. My committee on Delta Society for Animals in Prisons is working on that.
Why did they discontinue it?
I don't know. There's a lot of those things that I can't answer because it doesn't make sense. But it's true, my one of my laws, I think it's my 11th law, it states that to think that man acts logically is illogical. And the same goes for women. The first dog, and I mentioned this the other day, the first dog trained by Canine Companions for Independence, about over 9 years ago now, was Abdul for Kerry. Kerry lived with her folks, born with a very serious handicap, and was dependent on her folks. And they trained Abdul for between 80 and 90 signals. And he carries all her stuff. And she is now living independently at Rancho Santa Fe outside of San Diego and is running the Canine Companion for Independence training program there for that area. I was down to see her just not long ago. I had heard she'd adopted a child, but I'm not sure. So that's a real success story. And here... And it does all these signals. And here's Chris now and Ivy. You see what Ivy's doing? Ivy's pushing the elevator button for up. And it's changed Chris's life as it changed Carrie's life, these assistant dogs. It almost make you cry. In fact, I should point out that some of this is based on the Delta Society has money from various agencies where they give assistance. Well, first of all, we started out with giving awards for special programs for people in the media that have done special things for animals and for individuals for distinguished service and so forth. And one of our friends and great supporters is an old TV personality who was a real recluse. He'd retired out of the television business. Those of you from Chicago may recognize the word Bella Band. They had a big string of movie houses in Chicago in the old days, and where started the first telethon for epileptic children. But Bill is a neat guy, and he Why did I bring him in too? I got off the path.
A man
of illogical sense. Well, yeah, he's helping us finance. But what he did was, because his two dogs are so important to him, he says, you know, you're giving all these awards to people. He says, you should be giving them also to the animals. So we give special awards then, overall a special award to the animal, and then to a hearing dog, a guide dog, and a special assistance dog, and to a horse. And it may be also to some other animal. It may not necessarily be a horse. And this has been very successful. And it's the most popular thing, I guess, we do, and it gets a lot of hype. In fact, there's a book now being written about them. These stories really are tearjerkers. And I've already told you a little bit about Bert and Kathy. Kathy and I teamed up many years ago because she'd been incarcerated 35 times in 14 different institutions. We talked about how we could help out, since both of us have been prisoners, how we could help out people in prison with animals, because in the old days they always had animals associated with prison. And we talked about various strategies, and she says, she talked about halfway house, and then one day she came up with a plan. We'd go over to Gig Harbor to a maximum security prison for women, and she'd bring in her dogs and two of the best trainers she could find, and we'd train some of the prisoners to train animals to help handicapped people. And we'd have them meet the handicapped person. She says, I have the first recipient, because he wants a companion animal to help him, because Bert is just a little short guy. He's probably a thalidomide. He has trouble walking. He's a little short. He sort of shuffles when he walks. And he has only one long digit on this hand. One long one, two little short ones on this hand. He has trouble picking things up. When he falls down, he has trouble getting up. And he likes to go camping, but can't carry a pack. When the phone rings, takes about 12 rings to get to the phone. So brought Glory out there and trained Glory to do a lot of things. Here Glory answers, gets a phone for him in two rings, can open doors, pulls his wheelchair. He can call her over and say, Glory, stay, and she's like the Rock of Gibraltar. He can get up on her. She carries a pack, here pulling, of course, a wheelchair, and is a great companion and retrieves things for him. So it's been a remarkable thing. It's changed his life. He was director of Independent Living Center in Puyallup, and now he's in Houston doing the same thing, but wants to get back up to the coast. And his dog is now at the prison being trained again because he got into some bad habits. In fact, my recommendation is that he get another dog. I think it's too hard for him to pull that thing, and he has been, I think, doing some racing with it, and one of our very important responsibilities is to see that the animal, there's something in it for the animal, and not to injure the animal. This is a miracle story, and this is Angie and Sheba. Angie had, I mentioned her the other day, her folks, one or the other had to be with her at all times for the first 14 years of her life. She had a multiple array of seizures. Some of them would cause her to quit breathing, and then she'd lose her memory, whatever she'd learned. And she was confined to a wheelchair, in fact strapped in, because when the seizures came, she'd injure herself. And that was the state we found her in. So we took her to the prison, and a lady named Sue, who's become an excellent trainer. Sue is in for life, for reasons. Now Sue, of course, has become Angie, one of Angie's best friends. This dog picks up on her seizures before she even knows she's going to have a seizure. So that gives her a lot of leeway. She's thrown away her wheelchair, and the dog can detect a seizure in her. Even the other day in the Olympics for Junior Olympics for handicap, she was doing a handstand, and the dog detected she was going to come out of seizure, went over and interrupted it. And she can lay down and relax and pet the dog. often aborts the seizure, or if she needs help, the dog goes and gets her folks. We can intervene. Been a remarkable thing, and she's now taking junior high and high school work. And that's what led me to suggest it for epileptic children. I think we should look hard at placing an appropriate animal. It would, may well, in many of them, reduce the number of seizures and their extent, because it does reduce blood pressure, anxiety level, and stress. The latest dog they've trained over there, Sue and a girl, a lady named Dawn Yakes, Marsha Hinkle, two outstanding trainers, have been giving a lot of their time. The state has not been paying them even half for half their time they're spending over there. The latest training is a black lab named Bear. It's trained for a quadriplegic. And I saw the strip movie the other night in Seattle in a meeting where he dropped a pencil and the dog picked up one end of the pencil and got up and put it in the quadriplegic's mouth. The quadriplegic is in community college. And here you see it pushing the lights on. They can be trained, as I say, for 80 or 90 signals. I already mentioned this lady. You call this cat Handsome the Cat. You call it an assistance cat. I think it is. I told you about this lady. She had a seizure. No, she had a stroke and wasn't responding to anything, laying in a fetal position. And we said, we'll set up a therapy room in the combat center, put Handsome the Cat in, and you can decide who should go in there. And they all voted on Marie. And so Marie was in there, and she also had sores on her legs which wouldn't heal. Well, the cat, whenever she started scratching and sores on her legs, the cat would interrupt her. They seemed to be playing, you see. And in 5 weeks, she was all healed up. They had tried everything in therapy with her. And she was pretty much socialized in 8 weeks. Here was the 8-week picture after this. And so she had three and a half good years after this. I was up and talked to her. She was very pleasant and enjoying her cat. And now the cat's serving somebody else. And this is Walter I told you about the other day. It's for some of you. That's Boof. We got a prescription one day. We got a call about a prescription. He says, you got to help us fill a prescription. Walter's doctor has written a prescription for him. He needs a dog. That's the only thing that's going to help him, because Walter was dying. He just wanted to die. Didn't want to see his grandchildren. So he got Boof. Then he wanted to see his grandchildren, and old Boof was I guess you'd call it an assistant dog. Not necessarily trained for this, but we have. The prison also has trained dogs, like for the Foss home in Seattle, they train Foxy. I think Foxy's been replaced now. So they train him they don't need as much training for some of these situations, like in nursing homes, convalescent homes, or sometimes for individuals who don't have a special handicapped of great dimension, but as sort of a well-trained obedience dog and as company. And we've extended this, of course, for the prisoners, because not all the prisoners can train animals that become experts, or some of the prisoners can't train them to that extent. So we have a suggestion, because I feel very strongly that so many animals are placed by humane societies, but they're recycled, because they sometimes they return to the humane society for the same reasons they came there sometimes in the first place, behavior problems and other things. Well, if you can have these prisoners train animals, obedience training, just basic obedience training, because that's part of their training for these prisoners. They're obedience trained. They obedience train dogs from the Tacoma Humane Society, and then they're better placed, you see. They have better retention. Other people have copied this now, and it's proving out, appears to be proving out. And in fact, when I get to be dictator, I'm going to have all juvenile detention homes have them obedience trained dogs. Because I know I sent the chief to obedience school with Dingbat, and it really, really helped out. And so it's a good procedure. I don't know if you want to call this dog an assistance dog, but the physicians at the Denver Hospital for Children will probably go along with it. The Veterinary Medical Association at Denver, along with the physicians, so spent 2 years preparing for this. And then they introduced these dogs wearing the same gown as the person, reduced the dander and all, placed them in a cancer ward. And now, because it's been so successful, they've extended it to all of the children, all of the areas of the children's hospital, except the newborn and the intensive care. There's some indication now some people in intensive care will probably introduce maybe fish tanks and others in there. In fact, I heard of one the other day, they introduced a fish tank. If we get time, I'll tell you some success stories on that. And here's Major Anderson down at Brooks Army Medical Center with the children there. And it's been a great motivation for them, as it has at the with Dr. Bonnke at the head trauma unit in Houston. I visited just a couple months ago, where she insists that the animals are brought in and that the people in coma are pet the animals. And she's now doing a scientific study on this because she's seen some remarkable things happening with these visiting dogs. And this is a very interesting story. I mentioned a few of you about this. Is Taffy, belongs to Caroline at Peacock, and she did her thesis at Boston College for a PhD because of her experience with juvenile delinquents. She was a counselor, and she had permission for her thesis to interview 24 serious offenders before their hearing. 12 of them with their dog present, 12 without a dog present. And this has had phenomenal results. While clinical psychologists since the time of Boris Levinson have known this, they haven't talked much about it, but in a survey he did back in the 60s, I think, 40% of those he surveyed had used or prescribed animals. But it was not regarded as very professional. And she had fantastic results with this, 280 adverse comments in the absence of her dog, 40 with her dog present. Of course, the presence of a dog changes the whole milieu of the situation. We see it in all kinds of situations. And I've done a lot of TV and radio work, and I can usually tell within a minute whether a person is an animal person or not. And they have a different personality when you start talking about animals. And this is what happened here. You see, this serious juvenile offender. And she has found out now that it's one of the tricks she pulls is like if she has a very, and she's using this professionally now with all kinds of disturbed people, most successfully with adolescent girls who have had been sexually abused, who don't want to talk to anybody or trust anybody, but they trust the dog. And they're talking their heart out while they're petting the dog. It's probably the most petted dog in the United States. She has all kinds of TV clips now on this. It's fantastic to watch it. But she'll tell him, if she's having trouble, that this dog isn't very smart. In fact, he's no threat to anybody. His IQ is below detection, really. But he's a great dog. But she'll say, I've been trying to teach this dog to roll over, and I can't teach him to roll over. So they get down there and mix it up with a dog and teach the dog to roll over. But by the next patient, the dog has forgotten it. Maybe it's smart and realizes it's a therapy dog. But she's had great success with this, as many other people are. A good friend of mine, a psychiatrist, used to be with Alaska a Psychiatric Hospital, trained in Canada and Syracuse, named Dr. Kettner. And he usually brings his dog to his clinic or to his office. He rotates his dogs through. They're all Labradors. And now and then he invites people to bring their animals to see him. But now he's asking what kind of animal they have, because one of them brought his boa constrictor in one day and got loose, and it kind of disturbed everybody in the premises. These are cockatiels, but other kind of birds are also very therapeutic. And while I think of it, on my last trip, I think it was to London, When I'd suggested many years ago they started hearing the ear dog program, I told two of the hardest chargers in England this, and they really got it going. And so when their first public announcement of this was at a large meeting in London, they invited me to it, and they had a big press conference there, and they had me to introduce this dog to this couple that was going to receive him. They were at Devon, and they were both hearing handicapped and ran a school for disturbed hearing handicapped children. And I told them just what this was going to mean, and I told them about the chief and her dog. And I've been to a lot of interviews like this. But I think it's the first time that they ever applauded, because they're a tough lot, the correspondents, hopefully. But they realized, you know, what this could mean. As a result of this, we had a lot of interviews. One of the interviews I had was with Carol Thatcher. Her mother is, did she win the election again? Her mother's name is Margaret. Mm-hmm. And she's a legitimate correspondent. And she had done her homework. And she interviewed me in the London Broadcasting Company on a talkback program. And she asked good questions, but she had no sense of humor, no more than her mother. But it was a pretty good interview. And the first person, all the people that called in were handicapped people after our interview. And the first one, I'll never forget it, she was a blind lady. And she told me about her budgie, her seeing eye budgie. She said, in fact, just today, I had forgotten that I'd left the front door open. And I was going out the front door. And I walked over the front door, and just before I got to the door where I would have hit it, my cockatiel, who was on my shoulder, flew up my face and stopped me. Seeing eye budgie. And she says, it's been trained, it's usually out of its cage. She says, I let it fly around, but I have a what do you call it for the cats? The, pardon?
Litter box?
Yeah, a litter box. She has a litter box for this this bird. But I'm not sure she used it, and she probably doesn't know either. This is in the, these are from the Tacoma Lutheran Home, where we helped to establish the program. It's probably one of the most successful, where they even have a paid animal therapist there. And they've had a remarkable training, successful program, and among other things, they have cockatiels there, and the people like to go down and check if the cockatiels are, the eggs are hatching. They check many times a day on this. And then when they come, they finger train them, and they also teach them the wolf call. That always shakes up the visitors. And then they had one, it might be called an assistance dog, assistance animal. They'd have the people in there in the therapy room riding the bike. And there was one cockatiel who would sit on the toe and get a ride, you see. And then every time they stopped, the cockatiel would raise cane, you know. Screech and howl and get him going again. So I don't know if that's an assistance animal or not, but I think it is. This is a fellow that I hired when I was dean because he had been a quadriplegic, and he had gotten use of one hand, one arm and part of the other, but he could never ride a horse, but he'd like to drive. And more now we're seeing people establishing driving programs for those who can't ride for the handicapped, and it's a great comfort to them. We never really got the full-gone program at Washington State University. But old Bob is now, I wanted to hire him because I wanted my faculty and staff and students to understand what it is to be a handicapped person. In professional schools, you don't see very many handicapped people up until recently. And it was a real revelation to these people because most of them never knew a handicapped person to person. And I've seen this in prisons, how it changes the prisoners or changes students when they work with handicapped people and learn to know them as persons. It changes them remarkably for the better. And this is you could call this horse, I guess, a special horse. I think I showed this picture the other day to some of you. This is the St. Mary's Hospital for Children in South London. And this girl used to go over to their biggest riding for the handicapped program at that time in the world. And she had a favorite horse. And then she had terminal cancer. And on good days, they'd call over and say, bring her favorite horse over. She was on the first floor. And so they could open the window and let the horse's head stick in the hospital, in her hospital room. And so she fed it a carrot or something. It was very therapeutic for her. In their estimation. Children and hippotherapy, special horses now are selected, starting in Germany and I guess in Scandinavia, called hippotherapy. And they ride, this happens to be on a saddle, but they usually don't have a saddle on it. And they pick them out for a certain movement because it has a remarkable effect on their coordination. And I've seen spina bifida that are now walking. And it has a fantastic therapeutic effect. In fact, orthopods are prescribing
In fact, the orthopods are the ones running the program in a couple of places. One of the authorities in the world is in East Germany. We had them in our last international conference. And we're going to have
at the NIH conference on the human health benefits of pets, their conference being held in September, one leading people from Germany will be there to tell about this. They have third-party payments. There are some third-party payments here in the United States. Orange County, where I told you about, down in Orange County. Karen, she gets quite a few prescription people there from orthopods in the Los Angeles area in Orange County.
Now, are the programs themselves, are they funded at all by the county or the state or any kind of special program?
Not that I know of in the United States.
But are orthopods?
Orthopedic surgeons, yeah. But the reason I bring this up in our wards this year, our national meeting our North American meeting will be sort of international flavor though, because a lot of people are coming from foreign countries, is in Vancouver, British Columbia, on October 4-6. And we have these assistant awards, and there was it was almost a tie for the horse, but the other person won. And there's a 9-year-old boy in the Midwest, and he has a terminal illness, a chronic terminal illness, and they introduced him to riding, and to this special horse, and it just changed his whole outlook on life over the last number of years. And it was a really moving story. And when I and the executive director of the Delta Society read it, we said, we got to establish a new award, because he didn't win it, you see. And this is probably his last year of life. And so we've established the President's Award, and the family, and the whole family is coming, and their friends are coming out to Vancouver on October the 5th to receive the President's Award of the Delta Society. For his horse and for him. So it's going to be a great event, which we look forward to. So I'd call that an assistance animal. Some other time I'll tell you about how we select animals and the procedures we go through, but we look at temperament and how they perform in various situations. Here, meeting a person in a wheelchair or in a walker, and we take them through it and finish off with a room full of kids, and if they eat the kids, they flunk.
Mm-hmm. It seems like all different types and breeds,
yeah.
And are
oh yeah. In fact, that whippet there won that particular. It got the most points on that particular day down in Augusta, Georgia, when I was there. I couldn't believe it was a whippet. But she says, I went up to her and I said, this surprised me. She says, well, you don't know the secret behind it. I've raised this dog since it was 7 days old. So anything she did, the dog would do. Say okay with the dog, you see. And now the stars of the show, the chief and Bridget, and the trainer here. And now she's going to tell you all about this. But first we'll do a demonstration. You can never predict what will happen in demonstrations. This isn't how, you know, this is not the situation she utilizes. But we'll do a couple of things.
When I lost my hearing, which is very sudden, about 6 years ago, Leo said, well, we'll get you a hearing ear dog. And I said, well, I don't want another dog. We had Bridget, we got her when she was 3 years old, and she had been abused at some stage. And I had just gotten her to the point where she, you know, trusted me and wouldn't spend all her time under the table and so on. I didn't want to risk dividing her affections. Also, I didn't want to go down the road like this. Then Leo said, we had a friend who had offered to train her. She said it would take 2 months. He said, well, we'll send Bridget to Kathy and have her trained. I said, no, I don't want her to be sent away for 2 months. But Terry, the lady there with us, is a dog obedience trainer and a dog trainer, a dog field judge, I mean, a judge of training dogs and so on. And she said, I would like to try to train Bridget. I've never trained a hearing ear dog. And so we agreed, of course, it was a wonderful opportunity because ordinarily the dogs are trained in these different places. She came to our house 5 days a week with time out for taking her family on vacations and things like that for about a year. She would, and we trained her with liver. I'm very fond of liver. And she would poke the smoke alarm, and then and then she's a very vivacious person and would say, "Come on, Bridget, come on, Bridget," and she'd lead her to me and then pull her back, and we'd go. Originally we didn't go to the door, but we modified it and went to the door and went outside. Terry had got her instructions from the hearing ear dog people in Boylston, Massachusetts, and she was in contact with them. She tested her before she started, and she got advice when we ran into problems. Sometimes the advice wasn't as good as Terry's idea. For instance, what's the use of training the dog to run to the smoke alarm, you know? So, but anyway, the smoke alarm was the first thing. And then the alarm clock, which we demonstrated, and the doorbell. I was anxious for the telephone. Now, I have two hearing aids. I can hear these things if I'm in the room or close enough. But if I'm a couple rooms away, I don't hear. And I was missing some telephone calls. But that was a little more difficult because we couldn't be sure when they were going to ring. For the training, she would dial our number. And that works pretty well. I have and then at the end of the time she tested her, she had to have she had to sit and lay on command and heel, but she only 2 minutes for the sitting or the laying, which isn't enough for a lecture. So she wanders around. And she passed her, and then I got a card, our picture on it, Bridget and myself with our ID, and then on the back it says, "Please be informed that the person and dog pictured here are entitled to the rights and privileges contained in the hearing ear dog legislation in this state. This act requires deaf or hearing handicapped persons accompanied by hearing dogs to be admitted to all places of public accommodation, ride on all modes of public transportation, and reside in all public housing." Should we open it for discussion now?
Yeah, and point out that the smoke alarm was, of course,
very important to me because I'm gone so much, and Chief doesn't want anybody in particular. She wants to live independently when I'm gone. It was very critical that the smoke alarm, because at night she had no way she could hear it, you see. And it takes her, she said, first they suggested you go to the smoke alarm. Well, you want to go to an outside door if the smoke alarm goes, and that's what it's trained to do.
I could say one other thing. A lot of senior citizens, and some younger people, a lot of younger people too, have hearing problems.
About 18 million in the United States.
But I'm not deaf. I can hear. Like, I could carry on a conversation with you full face, because I also lip read. And, but if you want to talk to me, you have to and I'm not looking at you, you might have to touch me. It isn't necessary to speak loudly unless you have a very soft voice. And
not to accentuate it. You don't accentuate your talking when you talk to a deaf person.
No, and don't talk too fast. Mm-hmm. And if you have a mustache, trim it so I can see your mouth.
How do you hear on the telephone?
I have an amplifier, and I do fairly well. I do miserably catching a name. Names are very hard because you can't do any guessing. Like in a conversation, from the context, I can get a lot, but I have people spell their names, and sometimes I don't even get that. I tell Leo when he comes home.
Sometimes you say, call this number. If she has trouble, she call and give the message to somebody else.
I tell him, well, you had a telephone call from Washington, D.C.
It's a big help. I'm sure it isn't from a couple of people.
This dog has given you much confidence, though, hasn't it?
The dog has given you much confidence.
Oh, yes.
They're very good friends. It's a very strong bond there.
Yeah. And I'm not supposed to go. I'm supposed to keep that bond. I'm not supposed to go off for a two-week vacation and leave the dog behind, which is why I am privileged to have the dog at Holden Village, and the rest of you have to leave yours at home.
She's flown on an airplane with it. Yeah. They usually give you, like Northwest will give you, they'll meet and take you onto the plane, but you're probably up front, and then meet you when you come off. They've been very good about that.
Do they put a muzzle on the dog?
No.
Because you can take your dogs on the boats to Catalina, but they have to be with a muzzle.
I know, it's too bad.
How did you lose your hearing?
I had meniere's, and so then my right ear, the hearing had gradually gone down. So I was depending on my left ear. And then one afternoon,
April 14th.
Yes, in this ear. The doctor said and we hadn't had any experience with this type of thing, so we didn't realize we had to get there right fast to the hearing. But he said that it was that the inner ear, the cochlea has only one very fine blood vessel, and that this was choked, blocked by for some reason, and he thinks he didn't think it was the meniere's. That doesn't usually happen to the second ear, and it
only in 5% of the case, 5 or 10%.
Is meniere's?
Meniere's, it's terrible. Don't ever get it. You describe your meniere's.
Well, you're dizzy. And of course, there are varying degrees of it, but you can't. I can't walk. I can't.
You don't know which end is up.
There's the nausea.
Vomiting and retching. It's awful.
Yeah. And it comes, suddenly. You don't know when it's going to hit you. You go downtown and...
I got a call one day
from
the local insurance agent. And I just brought your... You can do this in Pullman, they'll close up their office and haul your wife home.
and called up and said, well, no hurry, I'm at your house and I just brought your wife home. She had an attack.
Do you still have these attacks?
No. I haven't had one for 2 or 3 years. And we talked to a woman who had the same problem. She had Meniere's and had lost her hearing.
She was younger.
She was younger. She had, it was an entirely, you know, an individual case. But anyway, she went to an acupuncturist and got her hearing back. And so we went
and
to...
And rid of her Meniere's. I mean, she didn't have dizzy spells either after that.
No. We went to the same acupuncturist, you know, you have to try anything. He said, it didn't help me, but he said he could not help if the nerve damage was too great. And evidently that was it. But he also said that the Meniere's, I mean, after you lose your hearing, you don't have these spells.
This fellow has had a lot of success. He's in Portland, Oregon. And we have to say, Chief, that transiently a couple of times during the treatment, you heard without your hearing aid.
Yes, but I've also been to a meeting since then. There's a great organization for hearing impaired people. It's called SHH, S-H-H, Self-Help for Hearing Handicapped. And we have meetings, and the man said, or someone asked a question. She said, you know, I could hear in the morning, I could hear my husband before I put my hearing aid on. And he said, well, you're rested, and your hearing is at its peak in the morning, mm-hmm. without acupuncture.
But I thought one evening you heard it. During the exercise.
I didn't remember that.
This fellow had success with some multiple sclerosis people, which was really phenomenal. Mm-hmm. And also he was turning off people on smoking. They take acupuncture. It's best for pain. And I talked to several of the people that came there for, they'd tried everything. Mm-hmm. And then you're one of them. It really works. This fellow is educated in China, and came to this country 12 years ago. He was trained as a physician there, but he's only an acupuncturist here. He's not in medical practice outside acupuncture. He's in the medical dental building in Portland, Oregon.
There's a person in California who does that for animals.
Yeah. There's quite a few now veterinarians who do it.
How do you spell Meniere's?
M-E-N-E-I-E-R-S, apostrophe S. Don't ever get it, boy, it's terrible.
Well, is it just kind of a genetic thing, or is it contagious, or how did
no.
you
well, no.
how do you get it?
It's kind of like a bucket of worms. I mean, it manifests itself in different ways.
It has to do with the water in your.
Well, we don't fully know what is involved, and what where you draw the line on Meniere's. I had a very severe attack of it many, many years ago of labyrinthitis, where I didn't know which end was up, and I was afraid I wouldn't die for a while, but it was transient. And it was probably an infection like a meningitis, a viral infection. But this Meniere's has sort of a syndrome, which does vary, and it may well be nerve damage or vascular damage.
The two friends of ours who had Meniere's, seriously, it came quickly and went quickly.
Yeah.
It arrived in a mysterious way, and it left in a mysterious way.
Yeah. We had some horrible experiences. In fact, I was scheduled to give the Wesley Spink lectures at the University of Minnesota. I remember it in 1979 in October, and Thursday morning. Early Saturday, Thursday morning, she, I heard a call from upstairs. I was downstairs, and I was in the basement. The chief was calling me, and she was crawling on her hands and knees. And so we hauled her off to the hospital. And then the next day, they checked her out and said, yeah, you can go. But she got another attack as we started to descend from Minneapolis. It was so hot. And then she got it at 2 o'clock in the morning the week later when we came to leave. But she had an attack several years before. I left her healthy in the morning. She went for a medical exam for her hip. And I was to meet her. And she didn't show where I was supposed to meet her. But where I was supposed to meet her, there was an emergency call for me from a hospital in Seattle. And she had gone down to Pioneer Square in Seattle and had an attack at Pioneer Square. She didn't know which end was up. And somebody, some good Samaritan in a bookstore there came out and took care of her. And they thought maybe she was having a heart attack and got the men back. But I took her home that night. And that was quite a few years, wasn't it, from then? How many years was it?
No.
When did you have your hip replacement? Yeah. The time before last?
It was in 1977, actually, that I had that first.
Yeah. And this was 2 years later then.
Yeah.
There's a lot we don't know.
But you would say, like, public approval has been very good for the program and for you individually?
For
allowing you to go, you know, public access and
yeah, there's still problems with it. Many people don't know about this. For example, when she was at Swedish Hospital just this last year, and I of course clued in the people there that they have to, most people don't know how to handle hearing people. And that's true with people in hospitals that are nurses and technicians and physicians. Huh? And I tell them, you know, how they're supposed to do this, and if it's really serious, they better write it down. And in the course of this, the assistant surgeon was up there, and I said, she has a hearing dog. He started to laugh. You know, hearing dog, you know, well, I've heard it all. He didn't even know what one was. And it's had publicity over the last 10, 12 years. And it's been in a lot of papers. But there's still a lot of people out there don't know it. And they got McDonald's, the Golden Arch, got into trouble this in Olympia. You know. A lady went in there with her hearing dog and they ran her out. Now they wish they would never have done it because she sued him and they were very embarrassed. Yes, that doesn't help your business. And we've had no trouble, but we don't push the thing. Like one of the few times we've taken it into a restaurant was in Idaho Falls on a very hot day. And we didn't want to leave the dog in the car. So she just went in with her ID without her dog and said, I have an ID, I have a hearing dog, and it's too hot outside and we'd like to bring the dog in with me for the meal. And they were very helpful. They said, yep, you bring the dog right in here and we'll seat you right over here. So if you do it right, and here, before I bring it on to the lady of the lake, I ride ahead and send them a card that they can fill out and reply if there's any problem. So they know the day we're coming, and the day we're leaving, so there's no surprise. Same with Northwest Airlines. I don't just do it by telephone. I have a paper that says, you know, we're ready for you. They don't like surprises. When I had her, it's very disturbing and very distressful for this dog when she leaves. And when she went to the hot, well, she was having trouble. She was on crutches before the last operation for her hip. And so the dog doesn't like her on crutches, you see, and she can't do a lot of the things. So.
She's afraid of the crutches.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so she went to the hospital. And the dog was distressed, you see, that she was in there, and I'd go in every day and visit her there in Swedish. And then we waited to get the right nurse as head nurse on a shift, on the day shift, that wanted the hearing dog there, you see. And I wasn't pushing it, but then we got permission. I said, well, we'll bring the dog on this such and such a day so they were prepared. And they, of course, admitted they couldn't deny it, you see, because legally they almost have to do it. You could raise quite a bit of fuss about it. But I wouldn't have pushed it. But I took the dog in. Now, there was a lot of dog in the hospital. I mean, you know, we're riding up there. I didn't know there were dogs in the hospital. But when we brought her up there, now, it was hard on the dog, and I didn't want to tell him this. But you see, the dog is not used to staying on the bed. It jumps up and lets her know and then gets off, except when we're gone. And we brought her in, and of course, they put a special robe on the bed, and they put it right in the bed, and the dog was very nervous about this, but happy to see the chief, but she didn't like all the smells and the strange surroundings. But she was getting more and more nervous, but they had to parade all the nurses through, and all the secretaries on that floor.